from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's only about the future of the Earth. That's why it leads to today's broadcast. Greenland's, well, let's see, let's start with this. The edges of the Antarctic ice sheets are slipping into the ocean at an unprecedented rate, raising fears of a global surge in sea levels. Glaciologists issued this warning beginning of this past week. The findings confound predictions made just 4 years ago by the UN's panel on climate change that Antarctica would not contribute significantly to sea level rise in this, the 21st century. In one area around the Amundsen Sea in West Antarctica, glaciers, you know, I'd love to have a sea in Antarctica named after me. I know they sell those things where you can have stars named after you. Celestial stars, not movie stars. Why don't they sell that? That'd be a good way to raise money for to keep it frozen, wouldn't it? In one area around the Amundsen Sea in West Antarctica, glaciers are dumping more than 110 cubic kilometers of ice. Don't know how much ice that is. Sorry. Talk pounds, babe. Into the ocean each year. This according to Eric Rigneau of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. This loss is increasing each year many times faster than the ice can be replaced by snowfall, he says. The impending ice disaster centers on Pine Island Bay on the shores of the Amundsen Sea, where glaciers, like many in West Antarctica, are perched on underwater mountains, meaning heard that warmer ocean waters are circulating beneath the ice and melting their bases at a rate of 50 meters a year. Anybody know how much that is? Nope, because we're America. Okay, there's that, and then there's this. Greenland's ice cap has thickened slightly in recent years, despite concerns that it is thawing out due to global warming, says an international team of scientists. The team led by Professor Ola Johansson in Norway report their findings in the journal Science. The 3,000-meter, there they go again, thick Greenland ice cap is a key concern in debates about climate change because a total melt would raise world sea levels by some meters. Glaciers at sea level have been retreating fast because of a warming climate, making other scientists believe the entire ice cap is thinning, but satellite measurements show that more snowfall is falling and thickening the ice cap, especially at high altitudes, say Johansson and his team. The overall ice thickness changes are approximately plus 5 centimeters a year, which is some inches. But they say the thickening seems consistent with theories of global warming, blamed by most of them. Warmer air, even if it is still below freezing, can carry more moisture. That extra moisture falls as snow. And scientists say the thickening of the ice cap might be offset by a melting of glaciers around the fringes of Greenland, but satellite data is not good enough. So it's good news or it's bad news or it's good news or it's bad news or it's hello, welcome to the show.
So these are the ropes, the tricks of the trade, the rules of the road. You're one of those dopes for whom they were made, the rules of the road. You follow that kiss and recklessly miss the bend in the road. And suddenly this, the end of the road. Now love is a hoax, a glittering string of little white lies. And these are the jokes. And what if they bring the tears to your eyes? Well, love often shows a funny return. The brighter it glows, the longer you burn. And God only knows love has little concern for the fools of the road. That's how it goes. You live and you learn the rules of the road. Thank you. it's a hoax, a glittering string of little white lies. But these are the jokes, and what if they bring the tears to your eyes? Well, love often shows the funny return. The brighter it glows, the longer you burn. And God only knows love has little concern for the fools of the road. Well, that's how it goes. You live and you learn the rules of the road. The rules of the road.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless. And the homeless are noisy today, it seems like. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of Le Show. And what, I'm supposed to push this button? Really? Now? Okay.
This is Harriet Myers, and I'd like to invite you to hear my confirmation hearings. Full coverage on this station, where you can hear the most brilliant radio show on the radio, Car Talk.
Wait a minute.
This is Harriet Myers. And I'd like to invite you to hear the coverage of our confirmation hearings right here on this station that carries the most brilliant show on the radio, Le Show.
All right, then.
This is Harriet.
All right, well, we've heard enough. I guess she's just, the flattery offensive is now moving beyond her immediate boss, which is a good idea. Just in time, too, I'd say. And before we do anything else, though, ladies and gentlemen, what we're doing, we're doing something else. Just the mere saying of it is something else, but let me read the trades for you. Always time for a rim shot. Larry Flint to expand porn empire with restaurants. Will I read that for you? How could I not? This is from Advertising Age, the Bible of the advertising business. As Larry Flint's porn empire continues to lose print circulation, the controversial publisher of Hustler magazine is further diversifying his holdings with plans to open a restaurant chain called Hustler Bar and Grill, with an E. Flint will have Mr. Flint will have final approval of all plans and will make personal appearances at each restaurant opening. That's appetizing. This latest addition to Flint's business portfolio joins a dozen hustler Hollywood retail stores, a handful of gentlemen's clubs. I don't think that's the right wording, actually. A handful of gentlemen's clubs. Is that the right collective noun for that? A hustler casino, 20 magazines, a dozen websites, and cable. The casual dining change will be an homage to hustler content. Larry Flint's brand of free speech advocacy and sports. What? Its 100-plus menu item, its 100-plus item menu will include fresh fish, pizzas, pasta sandwiches, burgers, and salads. Doesn't say which is the homage to what. We are left to guess, ladies and gentlemen. Described as Hooters meets Hard Rock Cafe, the concept is very mainstream, says Brad Saltzman, president of the firm that will be managing the place, with no nudity or entertainment. It really is a restaurant for all intents and purposes, he said, except that the food will be served by Hustler Honeys, H-U-N-N-I-E-S, wearing tight midriff-bearing t-shirts and short shorts. Hustler Centerfold models will make appearances to sign autographs. Flint says he accepts the chain will immediately be compared to Hooters, known for its buxom waitresses in tight t-shirts and hot pants. Hot pants! But insisted his restaurants won't be a copy of any kind. Quote, I expect it to be a class operation. We're not going to be like McDonald's, unquote. Said Saltzman, I've been to Hooters once. I don't think people go there for the food. If you have great food like a Cheesecake Factory with phenomenal service and an immaculately clean restaurant, and add that with Hustler memorabilia and Larry Flint memorabilia, and you really have a winning concept. I don't think you stay immaculately clean, though, do you? That's me talking. I'll get back to the reading. Saltzman concedes, however, it won't be the food that draws customers, at least at first. The Hustler Honeys will bring them in, but the food, the cleanliness, and the service will bring them back. Did you ever think you'd live long enough when Larry Flint would be an icon for cleanliness, ladies and gentlemen? Says Bob Golden, a restaurant consultant at Technomic, it's not the craziest thing I've heard of if they don't try to compete with just Applebee's or Chili's or Hard Rock Cafe. There's a huge market for pornography, he continues, and he's got a brand. Hooters is pretty PG-rated, and Hustler is as X-rated a brand if there ever was one. First four locations, Las Vegas, San Diego, Arizona, and San Francisco, because they appreciate good food and cleanliness, with Miami following thereafter. Like Hooters, the Hustler Bar and Grill is expecting 70% of its clientele to be men. I don't think many families will go, Mr. Saltzman said. Saltzman plans to cross-market with Hustler.com and use radio media buys on shock jock shows like Howard Stern's. He'd better hurry. Howard's going to someplace where they don't sell commercials yet. Mike McNeil, vice president of marketing for Hooters, said he wasn't aware of Hustler plans, but was adamant that his brand is very different from that of his new rival. Quote, there's a huge difference between Hooters and Hustler, he said. Female nudity is not part of our concept, and that's not a subtle distinction. If you compare us, clearly, female sex appeal is a key ingredient of the Hooters concept, but we would argue it's of a socially acceptable variety, a la Sports Illustrated or the NFL cheerleaders, that sort of thing. We're maybe somewhere between Hard Rock Cafe and Applebee's, unquote. And from another trade, a different story from governmentexec.com. The Homeland Security Department did not use a plan for handling catastrophes in its response to Hurricane Katrina, even though some officials say that doing so could have saved lives and brought the chaotic situation in New Orleans under control. The department did not activate a section of the National Response Plan that deals specifically with responding to catastrophes. DHS spokesman Russ Knock confirmed this week. The section, called the Catastrophic Incident Annex, is tucked deep within the 426-page plan, which was published last December. The plan is the blueprint for how federal, state, and local governments will respond to disasters. The Catastrophic Incident Annex gives the federal government special powers, including the ability to bypass state governments. But Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff, or one of his designees, has to approve the use of the annex. That was not done during Hurricane Katrina. Knox said the Catastrophic Annex did not apply to Hurricane Katrina. Quote, the annex is intended to be used during no-notice catastrophic incidents where there was no awareness of an impending disaster and no pre-staging of people, resources, and response, he said. During Katrina, the FEMA director was on scene days in advance. Coordinating preparations, resources, and response activities. Chertoff declared Katrina an incident of national significance on August 30th, but never activated the catastrophic section of the National Response Plan. This just in. They screwed up. From governmentexec.com, ladies and gentlemen, when I read the trades for you, copyrighted feature of this broadcast, that's the kind of conclusions you reach. But there's more. Yes, Mike Brown was on the scene. In case you don't know what he was doing, Marty Bahamonde, I don't know how you pronounce that name, regional director of FEMA, who was on scene, testified this week, and some of his emails to headquarters were made public, in which he's like screaming for help. To Deborah Wing, FEMA response specialist, August 28th. Everyone is soaked. This is going to get ugly real fast. An email from Sharon Worthy, Brown's press secretary, to FEMA's deputy director of public affairs on August 31st, 2 p.m. Quote, also, it is very important the time is allowed for Mr. Brown to eat dinner, given that Baton Rouge is back to normal. Restaurants are getting busy. He needs much more than 20 or 30 minutes. We now have traffic to encounter to get to and from a location of his choice, followed by wait service from the restaurant staff, eating, etc. Unquote. Bob Monday wrote back, I just finished an MRE with 20,000 other people at the Superdome. I appreciate his concerns. That's yesterday's Mike Brown today. Here's tomorrow's Mike Brown today. From PR Watch, George W. Bush has nominated to serve on the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which oversees U.S.-funded international media outlets, including The Voice of America, his campaign strategist, Mark McKinnon. Quote. Well, forget the quote. Not important. Anyway, his campaign guy running The Voice of America. Tomorrow's Mike Brown today. Meanwhile, back in Louisiana, cities, parishes, and school districts and sheriff's offices along Louisiana's Gulf Coast are out of money to pay for basic services, water, sewer, fire, security, that are necessary before rebuilding can begin. Officials say their pleas for help are falling on what kind of ears in Washington, class? That's right, deaf ones. This is the new FEMA. This is the new post-Mike Brown FEMA. Got their act together. We're in a crisis situation, a real state of emergency, says Jack Stevens, sheriff of St. Bernard Parish, which has been reduced to a physical and economic wasteland just east of New Orleans. I need a truckload of money. I don't need a truckload of water. But it's illegal to use FEMA money to pay for ongoing operating costs like deputy sheriff salaries or city maintenance work. A newly passed federal loan program was supposed to get money flowing, but authorities complained that bureaucratic hurdles are getting in the way. And some don't want to take loans because they've got enough debt. Are we giving loans to Iraq, or are those grants? U.S. Representative Charlie Melanson, a Democrat from the storm-ravaged areas, blamed the slow financial response on a culture of incompetence at FEMA. See, who says we don't have culture in this country? And a bias in Congress toward giving unrestricted money to Louisiana for fear it will be siphoned off by crooks. Well, there is that. If you don't trust the state, then give the money to the parish governments, he says, but get them the money. FEMA did not return multiple calls from Knight Ridder newspapers, where this report originated. No parishes have suffered worse than St. Bernard, where officials say, listen to this, 100% of the houses have been destroyed. Just 100% of the houses, ladies and gentlemen. Aside from that, they're doing well. And 75% of city operations infrastructure, such as vehicles and buildings, have been wiped out. Unlike New Orleans, St. Bernard went under several feet of water for days and now looks like an abandoned war zone. They need fire trucks, a water treatment pump, new pipes underground, $200 million worth of immediate repairs before you even get started. There's not been a single recorded taxable sale made in 49 days and no people to send property taxes to. So a budget that depends on sales and property taxes is at zero. Although Murphy Oil, one of two oil refineries in the parish, donated $2 million, part of which went to pay sheriff salaries. Private sector, ladies and gentlemen. And that's the new FEMA. And if that doesn't sound familiar enough, NATO has agreed to send 1,000 soldiers to boost Pakistan's overwhelmed relief effort as alarm grows over how to cope with a disaster now considered among the most difficult faced by the modern world. We're talking about the earthquake in Pakistan. 2 weeks after it ripped across northern Pakistan, an epic tragedy, says the Guardian newspaper. About 15,000 mountain settlements have yet to receive aid. International relief is chaotic and underfunded. Hundreds of thousands of survivors are at risk as the Himalayan winter, it's a nasty winter, approaches. President Pervez Musharraf describes as totally inadequate the $600 million in aid pledged by the international community. He estimated reconstruction costs at $5 billion. But immediate concern centers on the 3.3 million people made homeless by the quake. Why, that's more homeless than in Santa Monica. Think of it. Gee, if only we weren't spending billions of dollars some right next door to Pakistan, or nearby, anyway. The Brits have helicopters in Iraq and Afghanistan, but they didn't want to send those. So after several days' delay, they're sending three Chinooks. Not Chinooks, Chinooks from Britain. It'll take a little longer, but, you know, hey, bundle up. Bundle up, Pakis, quoth the Brits. Ladies and gentlemen, news from the digital wonderland. The U.S. Senator Ted Stevens, he of the multi-million-dollar bridge to nowhere that he refuses to cut out of the federal budget to help pay for Katrina disaster relief, that Ted Stevens, says he plans to propose a $3 billion subsidy. We got the billions to throw around for this. A $3 billion subsidy program to ensure older television sets will still work when they transition to digital, which, for some reason, this news medium that I'm reading from identifies as better quality. Yeah, maybe. Maybe not. Digital broadcast is complete. $3 billion just to make sure that you can watch. Stevens says the estimated cost of a box to convert the new digital signals back to analog so existing sets will continue to work is $50 each. He proposes the government subsidize $40 of that amount. But Australian Communications Minister Helen Coonan is concerned that Australians aren't switching to digital, aren't adopting the new technology fast enough. She thinks the Australian 2008 deadline for the shutdown of analog is unrealistic. It's not just us. It's the whole thing, ladies and gentlemen. It's the whole thing. It's all over. Now, news from outside the bubble. I think this has gotten some coverage, but just to give you the broad strokes. Colin Powell's chief of staff until January, Lawrence Wilkerson, says Vice President Cheney and Don Rumsfeld have hijacked the government's foreign policy. This is Colin Powell's chief of staff until January. Cheney and Rumsfeld have hijacked the government's foreign policy apparatus, deciding in secret to carry out policies that left the U.S. weaker and more isolated in the world. What I saw, he says, was a cabal between the Vice President of the United States and the Secretary of Defense on critical issues that made decisions the bureaucracy did not know were being made. Now it is paying the consequences of making those decisions in secret. Far more telling to me, America is paying the consequences. He says Colin Powell doesn't talk to him anymore because he's mouthed off, you see. Dateline Baghdad from Knight Ridder newspapers a week after that historic referendum. Hey, how that vote counting coming? Those people could use some Diebold machines. Man, that's a slow count. Iraq looks much as it did before the vote. Kurdish militias patrol the north. Warring Shiite Muslim militias wrestle for control in the south. And in the center, an insurgency supported by an angry Sunni Muslim Arab minority battles U.S. forces and the Iraqi government. It remains uncertain whether the new constitution and Wednesday's brief appearance of Hussein in court can halt or even slow the violence. This is according to Knight Ridder, as I said. The country is fragmenting, not pulling together, and halting its disintegration won't be easy. Most Sunnis and many Shiites lack confidence in Iraq's government, which many see as a caste of outsiders, including former exiles, who are more interested in religious and political causes than national unity or public services. Says a senior American official in Baghdad recently, maybe they just need to have their civil war. In this part of the world, it's almost a way of life. Unquote. What are you saying that Muslims don't have an inherent desire for democracy? Apparently he is. From the Telegraph newspaper in London, millions of Iraqis believe that suicide attacks against Western troops, especially British troops, are justified. This according to a secret military poll commissioned by senior officers for the Ministry of Defense. 65% of Iraqi citizens support attacks. Fewer than 1% think Allied military involvement is helping to improve security in their country. The survey suggests that the coalition has lost the battle to win the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people. The secret poll appears to contradict claims by General Sir Michael Jackson.
No, not that one.
The chief of British General Staff, who only days ago congratulated British soldiers for supporting the Iraqi people in building a new and better Iraq. The survey was conducted by an Iraqi university research team that, for security reasons, was not told the data it compiled would be used by coalition forces. 45% of Iraqis believe attacks against British and American troops are justified. 82% are strongly opposed to the presence of coalition troops. 67% of Iraqis feel less secure because of the occupation. 43% of Iraqis believe conditions for peace and security and stability have worsened. 72% do not have confidence in the multinational forces. And finally, news behind the bubble, beyond the bubble. Bush administration envoy Karen Hughes visited Indonesia on Friday as part of her campaign to repair U.S. standing with the world's Muslims. Defended the invasion of Iraq by telling skeptical students that deposed President Hussein had gassed hundreds of thousands of his own people. Her remark was wrong. State Department officials later acknowledged that Hughes, who was appointed by Bush to set the record straight on U.S. policies in the Muslim world, had misreported history. Although at least 300,000 Iraqis are reported to have died during Hussein's 24 years in office, apparently not from natural causes, his government's use of chemical weapons against Iraqi Kurds cost the lives of, notoriously, an estimated 5,000 people, not hundreds of thousands. Karen Hughes, ladies and gentlemen, making the world safe for us.
A cigarette that bears a lipstick's traces, an airline ticket to romantic places, and still my heart has wings. These foolish things remind me of you.
tinkling piano in the next apartment. Those stumbling words that told you what my heart meant. A fairground painted swings. These foolish things remind me of you. And you came, you saw, and you conquered me. One year you did that to me. I knew somehow this had to be. The winds of March that made my heart a dancer. A telephone that rings, but who's to answer? Oh, how the ghost of you clings. These foolish things remind me of you.
Beverly Hills Celebrities Futures Mart, one of the most unbelievable ideas in the whole .com world, where you, Mr. and Mrs. Celebrity Consumer, can actually invest, we don't call it gamble, on who's going to be the next hot, hot, hot personality in the world of fashion, in the world of music, in the world of movies, from the trading floor, which is just about to open, and the excitement you can just smell in the air. This is Strictly from Blackwell. I am Blackwell, and I don't know. I've seen this woman. I'm not going to dignify her with the use of her name, who has been on television with so many cosmetic surgery procedures done to and on her, and just brought there as a kind of warning flag. I don't know, an X marking the spot where you're not supposed to trample. And it just seems to me unfair, because people who have had 10, 15, 20 cosmetic surgery procedures who look good were not given equal time. And this just gives the wrong idea to the woman, to the man, to whoever, to whatever, who is thinking about looking their best. And, you know, I'm not saying, hey, Larry King, call me. Not at least. But there are people who can tell the other side of the story, whose faces mirror the other side of the story that must be told. We have good conversation today. Chanterelle Frazee,
mm-hmm,
from the National Basketball Association. We read this week what I think is just the best news since they brought back sliced bread, which is that there's going to be a dress code in the basketball thing. And you are here to talk. You are the commissioner of, not of the league, but of the dress code itself. Is that what it is? Welcome to Strictly from Blackwell.
Thank
you. Look fabulous yourself, I must say.
Thank you, Mr. Blackwell. No. I'm not the commissioner. I'm the enforcer. I'm the executive vice commissioner of the league for dress code enforcement.
Okay, good.
And the idea behind it is simply that we are a role model, and to the extent that our players are out there wearing the do rag, the cornrows, the oversized T-shirt, the retro jersey, if you will, they are not representing us as we, you know, we are $3 billion industry, Mr. Blackwell,
and we have to
dress like it.
This is,
you know, we're not a playground game.
No.
We are a top 500 business,
really,
according to Fortune or Forbes or one of them.
Interesting.
And so when you go to a game and you pay $100 a ticket at this point in time,
really,
Mr. Blackwell,
I
think you expect that the performers are going to be, even if they're not performing on a given night, especially if they're not
performing on a given night,
are going to look at least as good as you do.
Because I feel this way about almost every part of public life.
Okay.
Why would I go to a restaurant where the waiter looks like he has just come from the shower? I do not want this near my food. I'm not saying they all have to wear tails.
I hear
that
you.
Is a legacy, a heritage look, which is not coming back. But let's just pretend that going out is an occasion, can we? I mean, I don't go to these games. I wouldn't know what part of town they hold them in. But I hear what you're saying, and I like the way you look when you're saying it.
Well,
but what I want to know is who is dressing the players.
Well,
and can you do something about the referees? Because the stripe, I see it on television, and I just go, stripes, vertical stripes. What are we doing here? These people are not overweight matrons. These are not actresses of a certain age. It's so wrong. Can we do something about that? And also the people who bring you, the drinks and the food. I mean, if you're going to dress the experience, dress the whole experience, don't you think, Chanterelle?
Well, I don't make the policy,
Mr.
Blackwell.
I
enforce it, as I think I indicated earlier.
You did.
The referees are a whole different ball game, so to speak, if you will.
Yeah.
They're in different union, different agreement, we don't think that there's an image problem with the referees, per se, as you will.
Yeah.
We think that, you know, the question of refereeing has to do with the calls and maybe the reintroduction, if you will, of the instant replay in other situations than it's now available in.
I agree.
As far as the concessionaires, that's an individual stadium matter. What we control is the players,
and that's
what we market, and that's what we are attempting to dress up for the occasion. And I agree with you, it is an occasion.
Okay, good.
Parking alone would tell you that.
Okay, good. Chanterelle, we'll get back to you. But the answer to my question, who's dressing these players, might be the person sitting right here on the other side of the table, Joe Dixie, who is one of the rising young stars of the fashion design world. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you.
From Michael.
Thank
now,
you.
There is a designer who got attention this week, and we're not going to mention his name because that's the kind of attention he was trying to get.
Well,
who said, I'm not going to dress celebrities anymore because they're too greedy.
Yes, he did.
They get these gowns, they get these designer clothes, custom made for free, and then they don't wear them. And we don't get him, and by we, I mean he don't get the publicity we expected. Joe, you have bones to pick with. with this. Right?
Well, I do. Yes. Mr. Blackwell, yeah. I'm about 5 years into my career.
I know, and it's
in
incredible.
The fashion design industry.
Yeah.
And my feeling is that celebrities represent something magical to the public and to us as well.
Incredible. Yeah.
And what they bring to the table is that magic in a form which, if you dress it, then your brand, your look, your...
Yeah, part of it.
Joie de vivre, you might say, is...
You're part
linked
of it. You're part of it.
With that brand of
You're
that celebrity.
Of
that's the whole premise. Yeah. Whether or not they wear it,
no.
They've got it in their closet.
That's
Mr.
right.
Blackwell.
That's right. That's
they
right.
know they
and
have
you,
the
and
garment.
You, and you know.
And to me,
just
that relationship imbues me with the
with
magic.
The magic.
You see?
Yeah.
And this is not just a business, Mr. Blackwell.
No.
Fashion was just a business. I know I wouldn't have been in it, and I don't think you would have been either.
No, I wouldn't.
Because we're not accountants.
No.
we're in it for the magic. We're in it for the glamour.
Yeah, yeah.
And if that's not what celebrities provide, you know, hit me with a spoon.
Beat me with a spoon, I know.
Yes.
Joe, do you feel that dressing NBA basketball players for business casual is something you could do? What I'm getting from you is you don't mind giving your garments, your creations away.
No. I'd give them all away if they were all worn by celebrities.
Interesting.
Because in the long run, what's the name Joe Dixie going to mean in 5 years? Unbelievable glamour, magic.
Magic.
How do you achieve that?
Celebrities.
Have your stuff worn on the red carpet. Have it worn sitting on the bench by NBA. I would love to do that.
Okay.
I would love to give. I don't do a men's line right now, but for the NBA players, I would move heaven and earth to do one.
Chanterelle, is that something that would be interesting to you? I mean, I hate to do a deal right here on the air. But
I don't think that's going to happen, Mr. Blackwell. Okay. The players have their own business arrangements normally for their fashion needs.
But
if they don't, I'm sure that the league would be interested in anything for free.
Well,
okay. Well, I think something magical is going to happen after the show, as is usual and strictly for Blackwell. But we must put the end to this experience. Joe Dixie, Chanterelle Frazee, thank you so much for making good conversation. Come back in style. Next time, the spring collections. Can we hold back the calendar, please? Till then, Strictly from Blackwell. Bye-bye. Drop me a line, baby, one of these months.
This is Le Show, and just a couple of dog trainer corrections for you. The forecast for Scorpios in the astrology column in Tuesday's paper said water boiled at 112 degrees Fahrenheit. The boiling point for water is 212 degrees. An article in Friday's paper about the Los Angeles literary anthology Women on the Edge referred to the late Kate Braverman. In fact, Braverman is living in Northern California. A profile of B.B. King said the blues musician had been married and divorced twice with no children. King had no children with either of his wives, but fathered 15 children with other women. And an article on October 9th about a Foucault pendulum in Bologna, Italy, where residents recreated the experiment that showed Earth turns on its axis, said the pendulum ball swept back and forth, quote, propelled by an unseen magnetic force, unquote. It is gravity and the Earth's rotation that caused the pendulum's shifting sweep, not an unseen magnetic force, ladies and gentlemen, lest you be misinformed by your newspaper. Now, speaking of media, Howard Stern's ratings are down as he prepares to leave commercial terrestrial radio for Sirius satellite radio. So I guess he's going to have to find a lower grade of starlets to spank in the intervening time. And, of course, there's the Judith Miller story. Last Sunday in the New York Times, the paper published a wea culpa, and then Judith Miller published a first-person account of what went on in her dealings with her source or sources. She's identified one source, Chief of Staff to Vice President Cheney Lewis Scooter Libby, but wouldn't identify the other source, who she believes is the source of the name in her notebook, which she incorrectly wrote down as Valerie Flame, it being, of course, Valerie Plame. Some facts, interesting facts came out, and the New York Times has now responded to Miller's account. The editor of the New York Times sent an email to his staff saying, I wish we had dealt with the controversy over our coverage of weapons of mass destruction as soon as I became executive editor. Judy Miller wrote most of the stories about WMD. At the time, we thought we had compelling reasons for kicking the issue down the road. He says he wishes Judith Miller had been more forthcoming with him about her dealings with Lewis Libby, so the paper might have been more open to a compromise as opposed to standing behind her as she served 85 days in jail. Some of the facts that came out in her account, she was an embedded reporter with the military at one point in the Iraq thing, and showed up many times wearing a uniform. Even though Lewis Libby told her at least one untruth, he told her that the classified national intelligence estimate of October 2002 was even more convincing about Saddam's WMDs than the unclassified version. That turned out not to have been true when the classified version was unclassified later, but she still describes him in her piece as a good faith source. And she reveals that the new incoming editor, Bill Keller, tried to tell her not to cover WMD issues, she drifted back. Well, I think he tells us that. She tells us that she was known in the newsroom as Miss Runamuck.
I'm the queen of the newsroom. My colleagues eye me with gloom. They came in with a new broom, but me it couldn't sweep. I'm the one they had to keep, because I've got the access. When I'm around, the VEEP relaxes, ignores taxes, and just leaks. I'm the open ear he seeks. It's through me the leakage courses. I got all his secret sources. I was in the armed forces, embedded up to here. Wore the uniform to cheer and to back up my supporting. I even dabbled in reporting. Miss Runamuck, that's what they call me at the paper. I'm capable of any caper till I run out of luck. Miss Runamuck, not the name I write under, but my words crack with thunder till you wonder what I'm smoking or sucking. Cause the plums I was plucking had to come from something more than pluck. From Miss Runamuck. I'm the queen of the newsroom, the one they couldn't not groom, even though I wrote Valerie Plume, or was it Flame, I can't remember. Taking notes is such a drag, each word a dying ember. Who said what and when, it's not my bag. what's then is then. So I'm a pal of Chalabi. He had a tall tale or two for me. Some say I should have checked it out, shown some doubt, but if I'd put him in a cage, put a hold on his outrage, kept his notions off the stage, pulled the curtain, only one thing is certain, no matter how prudent or sage, I wouldn't have made the front page. This Ramamuck, not my name in the slammer. Was it Valerie Flammer that I wrote in my notes? At least the gals in the joint got my point. I got sprung, they're still stuck. I'm Miss Ramamuck. Miss Ramamuck. If my friends are indicted and they lose, I might have to go back to news. Step down, I'd lose my crown, have to withstand the frowns of all the clowns at the Times. The nickel dimes who think because I'm in the Libby lobby. Not Libby, he's a crank. Libby's a one-man think tank. You don't get mad at your horse when he spills you if he's a good faith source. But the naggers at the rag think I walk and look and quack like a duck. Cause I'm Miss Runamuck.
Ladies and gentlemen, a listener says a cubic kilometer equals 2 quadrillion pounds. Thank you for that, sir. That's why I didn't study. What the hell's a quadrillion? 10 to the something. Ladies and gentlemen, that is going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ 7.415 megahertz, Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 136, around the world via the internet at two different locations, whenever you want it, live and archived, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available as a free download at www.audible.com/theshow, and available as a podcast for free at kcrw.com. And it would be just like Judy Miller getting a new job if you'd agree to join with me then. Will you?
All righty, thank you very much.
The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack, a tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks. The show playlist available at harryshearer.com. I'll see you at Eat the Press at www.huffingtonpost.com. And bidding a fond premature farewell to Shirley Horn. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica. It's a community recognized around the world as the home of the overamplified homeless.